Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by comedians and podcasters Graham Clark and Dave Shimka. In the very first season of this podcast, we tackled a small portion of the kung fu boom of the late 70s. But by the 80s, the kung fu craze had expanded to include karate. And in 1984, The Karate Kid came fifth in the box office, coming just below such little-known films as Ghostbusters, Beverly Hills Cop, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and Gremlins. And that kind of success breeds exploitation movies. Martial arts movies are cheap to make. Well, the slipshod ones are, which makes them easy to exploit. Luckily for us, it spawned two bananas genre blend movies that involved martial arts that would be released in 1985. Are Gymkata and The Last Dragon so bad they're good? Or are they just really bad? Now, before we get into that, Graham, let's start with you. Were you a karate kid?
I think I was, because also Chuck Norris was big at the time when I was a kid. So I think, I think everybody I knew wanted to do karate when we were about maybe a few years after 1985, but for sure, that was the thing to go. And, you know, every parent ended up having to buy their kids a karate uniform that they then never wore ever again. So
it was a great Halloween costume. Like, yeah, I feel like exactly. 84 through like 90, maybe. It was just like, get my kids some black pajamas, throw on a balaclava, they're a ninja.
Yeah, they're ninja, exactly.
Send them on the streets, fully visible. It'll be great.
I had a friend, too, that was, like, full karate. Like, he went all the way to getting a, like, triple black belt or something like that. But he was, like, into it. I was into it, you know, fancifully. He was into it, actually. And he could beat me up, no probs.
Dave, did you have those kids at your school that at lunchtime would be, like, punching and kicking the air at each other and inevitably would miss and smack somebody and a teacher would be called?
Yeah, I was one of those kids. But... I never smacked anybody, but I was very obsessed with the idea of like a jump kick and like
yes.
I wanted to be do karate just for like one photograph, but
just one shining
to, this one thing
moment.
Where your fist is out, and your leg is out, and you're in midair
as the sun is rising behind
yeah,
you, hopefully
exactly.
In that perfect capture moment. So what you're saying is you were like tempting into Instagram before Instagram was happening.
Exactly.
You were like, I know the shot. It's going to happen.
Yeah. Unfortunately, no one wanted to take a picture of me. And if they did, I would have to wait 6 weeks to get the pictures developed. And
well, this is what's so wild to me about this time. And I was kind of looking into like, okay, why was 1985 like the hot button thing? So we've got The Karate Kid, obviously, sort of launching all of that. But this is also the year of Ninja Turtles. This is the first year this comes out, the animated series and the comic book, which, of course, have you guys read the comic book?
Yes.
No. Yeah.
No. Okay, Graham, the comic book's very different from the TV series.
It's gritty. The comic book's gritty.
It yeah. is. Yeah. Yeah. It's very weird that you would take one and then interpret into the other. It's like, you know what kids love? Turtles and ninjas.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just put them together and mutation, genetic mutation explained in a really terrible way.
It's all I was interested in as a kid. Those three categories.
You know, I ended up watching the Bruce Lee box set with my sister when we were growing up. I think she was like 14 or 15. And she was so traumatized by Chuck Norris's back hair for some reason. Or sorry, his chest hair. The fact that it like wrapped all the way around like it was giving him a hug upset her on levels I've never seen like follicular things upset anybody.
Well, now
it's
that
really
I know about it, I'm upset too. I only ever saw him with a shirt on, and now I feel betrayed.
All right. Well, we're going to get into Bruce Lee and Bruceploitation into some of our films in a bit and chatting a bit about him. So our first movie today, I love so many movies that were built on the premise that people love these two things, even though there's no evidence they will go together. But let's see how much money we can make on where the Venn diagram will meet in the middle. And Gymkhana is one of those movies. Now, before we get into it, what you need to know on the outset is that before the 1984 Olympics held in Los Angeles, it was widely thought that that was going to be the last Olympics ever. However, because of a series of savvy maneuvers by the organizers involving media and technology, it became the most watched television event ever, including up to this day, and made stars of a number of Olympians. The star of our movie today, Kurt Thomas, was not one of those Olympians. We'll get into why later. But one Mary Lou Retton was, and that spunky gymnast made gymnastics an overnight sensation with people clamoring for gymnastic content. Were they clamoring for a movie that combined karate and gymnastics? Well, Schlockmeister Fred Weintraub sure thought so, and thus we get Gymkhana. And thank God we did, because I actually really love this movie. I think this falls into the so bad it's good category. But Dave, you don't agree with me. You think this is just bad.
Yeah, I think most people would say it's very, very bad. No, I'm too hard on Gymkhana. No, you're right. It's good.
It's just bonkers. Like it's one of those things where, like, if you tried to make something like this, you couldn't. There is an earnestness in the filmmaking of this that just shines through and is just delightful.
And what's the name of the star? Kurt?
Kurt Thomas.
Yeah, he didn't have a big acting career before or after this, as far as
no.
I can tell. And it's amazing why.
Before this, he was appearing in a number of commercials, and it's one of the reasons he wasn't able to be in the 1984 Olympics, because at that point they had really, really strict rules of what an amateur was. And if you had sponsorships in after like a certain level, you couldn't compete. And so he actually was known as a spokesperson for KFC, of all things. So there is this Perfect. Amazing ad where he is pommel horsing, and then he jumps off the pommel horse and like takes this tentative little bite of chicken and like just like,
That's dangerous. It's That's amazing. Dangerous for a gymnast to have greasy hands like that.
Yeah.
Also, if it's finger licking good, you're getting all that chalk That's in your mouth.
Right. It's kind of a counterintuitive sponsorship opportunity. And then he was also in a TV series called True Confessions, which is based on True Confession magazine. Are you familiar with this?
Oh,
is this a saucy magazine?
100%. So what people would do is they would like write in their like true confession stories of like, you know, they had illicit lovers or whatever. He was in an episode about gymnasts, obviously. The series was hosted by Bill Bixby, of all people. And if you go online, you can see clips. They don't have the whole episode up, but you can see clips. And this thing is exactly as cheesy and ridiculous wow. and fun as you think it would be. So, yeah, Kurt Thomas, not a huge career in acting, but he also did a bunch of commentary and stuff for like ESPN, stuff like that, because he knew what he was doing. Like, he really was an incredible gymnast, which you do see in Gymkhana. Am yeah. I right here?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there's definitely gymnastics in it.
Well, before we go any further, Dave, do you want to give us a quote unquote plot summary of this one?
Sure. So it starts with Kurt Thomas, who plays, I don't know, Jake?
For Clyde.
he is training, and then some CIA guy is like, well, your training is done. Time to go put it into action, and we're going to have you go compete in this game in Parmistan, which is presumably the place where they make Parmesan. And they take him to the other side of the world. And he's got to compete in this game. Oh, alongside the daughter of the, what was it, the Shah?
He's like an emperor of some sort.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he, so they become hot and heavy. And then he's got to go compete in this game because it will give America some kind of tactical advantage in Star Wars, not the movie, but the missile launching a thing against Russia. So they send him over there, and he competes in this game against like one really big strong guy, one guy who knows martial arts, and a bunch of just like mafia guys in tracksuits. There's a bunch of just nobody, like guys who are, you know, they're going to die.
What do you want to bet? One of the producers had some sort of investment in tracksuits. He was like, I can get a few of these that fell off the back of a truck. Here we go.
And then he, so he completes this course, and he's also got to defeat the traitor to the emperor. And he does. And you know what? Oh, yeah. And the big climax happens in a castle that has been converted into a mental institution for the criminally insane. We can talk all about how sensitive this movie was to mental illness. Yeah. But he defeats everyone. And he's reunited with his dad, who he thought died in the game years earlier. And America gets to launch their missiles or whatever. Oh, also, I forgot to mention that he encounters several gymnastics apparatus along the way to help him fight, including a high bar and a pommel horse. I looked up all of the men's apparatuses, and there was no vault, right. And there was no rings that I noticed. But I think he did everything else. He did the pommel horse, the high bar, and the floor exercise.
The tumbling. Well, yeah. He was known for his tumbling specifically. He did these, he actually has somersaults named after him that no other person has been able to kind of do. And apparently one of them, it was disqualified entirely from competition because it was too dangerous.
Oh, wow.
So he's a pretty intense guy. What is your favorite moment where they attempt to disguise a piece of equipment, guys?
I mean, the pommel horse is pretty... That was my favorite when he was like really up against it, and
it's because it's a just like a chunk of something with handles on it.
I like the high bar in the middle of the streets where it's just like, yeah, of course, that you just have bars connecting these places. And then like the bar in the tree as well, that's like very well hidden by a few sparse branches.
Yeah.
I'm like, this
yeah.
is very impressive.
There's also a lot of ropes in it. I don't think ropes are those are more of a gym class thing, not quite a gymnastics thing.
But he would also climb the ropes and have his legs stuck out like a gymnast. Like if there was a rope climbing, that's how
it was like a Jean-Claude Van Damme move, right? Where like he does like the splitty thing and kind of hauls himself up that way. That was the one moment where I thought there was an opportunity for a stunt that didn't happen, where I was like, if this was actually happening, that would be a really cool stunt where when the guy is setting the rope on fire at the bottom and he has to climb to the top, I was like, if he's actually climbing that thing with the rope on fire, that would be really cool. But they cut away enough times that I don't think that was actually happening.
No, or he could have jumped to another rope.
Yeah.
That would have been cool.
Yeah, it was weird that,
there was another time the bad guy cut a rope, and I thought he was going to, like, swing down and have to save himself. But he just swung down about 2 feet.
I also like that the powers of the other guys that are competing just appear to be, they're big. Like, that's about it.
Yeah, all the guys that die really quick all look like people who drive a cab. They all look like, like different. they all had the same hairdo. And they were like they were all kind of like early 50s, I want to say. And then,
there were a lot. It was like he was in some kind of uncle race.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. But he also, like, his training seems like it took place over like 2 fall days or something like that. Like, it's he seemed like he was well equipped. But why didn't they just send the people who trained him in to do this gymkhana if they were so good?
Well, because he had to be trained by multiple people to put everything into one tiny little gymnastic package in a montage that goes on forever. Okay, I'm not sure. This may have the longest training montage in film history and the longest slow motion scene, because that scene in the village of crazy people, which I know is not politically correct, 6 minutes straight of just slow motion. And I was like, that is one way to pad your runtime, guys. Well done.
I liked it. There was one scene where he was hitting on the woman, the love interest, and he kept doing flips and being himself and then talking to her and then flipping back and forth.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was a pretty good use of flips.
Did you guys notice this is based on a book?
Yes. At the end, I was shocked.
Okay, so what's wild about the book is that it has actually been in development since the 50s, and the starring role was originally intended to be Rock Hudson, of all people. It was written by Dan Tyler Moore, who, among being a noted author, was also a lieutenant in the U.S. Army, who was noted because he blinded Teddy Roosevelt in a boxing match. He hit him so hard his eye got messed up. So there's that.
What a resume.
Yeah.
Totally. But the book was originally set in like medieval times, and like it was still about military strategy. But you were saying earlier, it's about the Star Wars program, which, if people don't know, that was like a satellite laser delivery system that the United States would be able to basically shoot off missiles into Moscow from a distance and, you know, destroy everything. It's interesting how all of that sort of fits into that very 80s narrative of it's us versus any sort of dictatorship, more than likely the Russians. Mm-hmm. But we're also working with the what appears to be a dictatorship in order to go against another dictatorship. Does that track for you guys?
I think you thought it through more than the producers did. did the original book also have gymnastics in it?
No, it did not. He was just a multidisciplinary. So originally, this wasn't supposed to be Kurt Thomas. This was supposed to be Christopher Atkins. Do you guys know who that is?
Oh, from the Blue Lagoon?
Yeah. Unfortunately, Christopher Atkins around 1984, 85, 86 was suffering from some fairly serious substance abuse issues. He had a much publicized breakdown in 1986. But Fred Weintraub, who produced this, he believed that he had discovered Bruce Lee. We'll get into that in a minute. And so he was like, you know what I can do? Make another star. And so he was like, Kurt Thomas, this seems like a guy who should be in a movie.
He's also very tiny. That's the other thing that people who haven't seen it, he's a very tiny little man.
He's 5'4".
5'4", yeah. He's itty bitty.
But I think that makes a good movie star.
That's true. Yeah.
Like small body, big head.
And a big smile. Like he's got a good, what I do appreciate is that he seems like he's trying. Like mm-hmm. He's not good at it, but like he genuinely seems like he's doing his best. His line deliveries, he says them with like this little like Hollywood smile, half smirk.
Yeah.
Don't trust anybody, right? Sometimes you just got to take a chance.
Yeah, he doesn't have that thing of like, oh, I'm in a bad movie and I know it. He doesn't know he's in a bad movie, but it doesn't come off as like pitiful. Like I'm not, oh, this poor guy doesn't know he's in a bad movie. No, this is his movie.
Yeah, and he does seem to be. There's a couple lines that he actually smiles while he delivers them. So he's exactly right. Like. They all kind of know that. I'm sure the pommel horse scene, they all had a good laugh at before they shot.
Well, he actually did say that. He said they did their best to disguise it, but because of the way pommel horses are specifically built with, like, the handholds, he just couldn't do the kind of stuff that he needed to do. And they tried it over and over, and they were like, all right, we just got to make it look like a pommel horse. Let's just do that.
Yeah, well, it worked. That was what I was waiting for the whole film. So, yeah, it's – I don't know. Like, I got so lost in the plot. I couldn't understand what was going on. Because, yeah, why was he racing in this 100-year-old competition? And the first day they go after some prisoners that they let free.
Yeah,
and
they just watch other people race.
Yeah.
Premise, from what I understand, I think the premise is it's a notoriously isolated country. And if you can complete the competition, you are granted one wish because that's what you do. the Khan can just do wishes. And so that would be his wish would be like, we want to put a military base here for the United States. And I guess they just have to do that. NATO be damned.
I literally didn't know about the wish thing. I didn't realize that was part of it.
And so the game itself has weird rules where there's these people holding flags, kind of, I guess, like showing you where to go.
Yeah.
But sometimes they'll just put their flags down. I think they just got lazy. And then you're racing, but you're being chased by people who want to kill you. But they're not allowed to kill. You're only allowed to kill you on your level. If you get to the next stage, they have to get to that next stage too before they can kill you.
What do you guys think it's like to be one of those flag guys? Like, how do you think they got that gig?
By being the worst at their job. Whoever wasn't a good enough henchman.
Yeah, like by being too ugly to be in the other scenes, and so they had to wear a mask.
There's another part in it that I loved where he was, whoever was the guy that was running things, was showing him where they run on like a little model that he had made. And like it was, there's no reason that the model would be there. You could have just said what it was going to be. Like first you run, then you go up a hill. But they had this little diagram all made. And then there's a scene where they like make them run through corn. That's like the first leg of the trip is that you have to run through
A corn field, not just like a bucket of corn.
One of the things, I turned to my partner at one point, we watched this together, and I turned to him and I said, at what point wouldn't you just like hide and just let everybody go past you and then finish afterwards? Can you not, just, especially in the corn, like why couldn't you just do that?
Yeah. And also everybody else that ran through the corn, you could see their head above the corn, but not him.
Yeah, this is why they had to send him, because he had specific skills and physical attributes for this particular endeavor.
I'm so glad you told me about the wish thing. I can't believe I missed that.
Well, yeah, like what if at the last minute he was like, I wish I was taller.
Then they would get out the silicone injectors and just go for it. He would have the tallest forehead known to mankind. That's what they do in sumo wrestling, eh? There's like a couple sumo wrestlers who are too short to go in the big leagues, so they get silicone injected into their head to make them tall enough to compete.
What? Gross.
Yeah, it's a thing.
Cool.
Yeah, you're just learning things all over today.
Yeah, don't let your genetics tell you what's what.
I was thinking about a movie like Ocean's 11, and it feels like that's the kind of movie that Kurt Thomas should be in. Like him fitting into tiny spaces, helping people out by doing weird acrobatics. You know what I mean? Like he's part of a team. He's not a solo operator.
Oh, sure. Like with, they could do like the Expendables, but it's just gymnasts.
Get Mary Lou Retton in there, and she's just like got a knife between her teeth as she crawls through tiny things.
So you asked about if we were karate crazy as kids. My sisters were gymnastics crazy. And at the cabin that my parents had, they would do this thing where there was a sunken living room, and you would run up and try to land perfectly on the first stair, and then the second stair, and then the third stair. And they would always pretend to be Mary Lou Retton, and they made me pretend to be male gymnast Mitch Gaylord.
Yay! Could you ever land it? Where were you? And how many people were injured in the making of this activity?
No, this was like a pretty easy. Like it was a game of inches of just like whether you know, as my sisters would say, stuck it. you would try to stick the landing. That was, but it would be like, you know, oh, you wobbled too much. There was no chance of getting hurt.
All right. Well, before we wrap this segment up, I wanted to get into the producer, Fred Weintraub, a little bit, because he's a really interesting guy. So his claim was that he had discovered Bruce Lee, which isn't actually true, because Bruce Lee came to California when he was 18. He was working in restaurants and he was developing his own style of martial arts called Way of the Intercepting Fist. And he was doing a bunch of exhibitions and really kind of honing his skills at that point. He was also a child star in China, so he had performance experience already. So he was discovered by another producer and put in the Green Hornet TV show in 1966. And that was canceled after one series. And he's like, oh, okay, I have my in and I can really show people what I can do here in Hollywood. That didn't really take off. He pitched the show Kung Fu the Legend, which they went forward with. But of course, they did not cast him. They cast a white guy.
Oh, with David Carradine?
Yeah, that's the one with David Carradine. So he went back to Hong Kong, where he made three movies. And then he was rediscovered by Fred Weintraub, who found him training, of all people, Steve McQueen. And so he brought him back to North America to do a Hong Kong Hollywood co-pro, which ended up being Enter the Dragon. And Bruce Lee unfortunately passed away before Enter the Dragon was released. But the movie and how cool it is, and watching him do his thing, coupled with his mysterious death, quote unquote, is what really launched Bruce Lee to another level. So if you don't have Enter the Dragon, we don't have Bruce Lee as the icon we know him as. But aside from that, Fred Weintraub was also a bit of a star maker in that he owned the New York club, The Bitter End. Graham, are you familiar with this?
Yeah, that's like Bob Newhart and Smothers Brothers and that kind of ilk. Mort Saul would play at The Bitter End. Yeah.
Totally. Bob Dylan and George Carlin and Joan Rivers, all of them got their start there. And apparently it's the place where the brick background started for comedy clubs.
Oh.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, that's interesting. But he ran that for years and years and years. That also helped subsidize his movie producing.
Holy cow. This guy's amazing. Holy shit. What a resume.
I know. So Kurt Thomas had like every right to be like, you know, there's potential that I could go somewhere as an action star in this. This guy discovered Bruce Lee. I mean, lightning doesn't always strike twice. I'm just saying Bruce Lee had some other skills that were going on.
But yeah, it was like it's a fun enough. It's a better plot than any Chuck Norris movie that I've ever seen in my life. Like it's probably more fun than any Chuck Norris movie I've ever seen. So it's you're right. He had a reasonable expectation that this would be a good film to be in.
I had never seen this before, but I had heard it like it's a famously bad movie where he discovers these apparatus, pommel horses and bars as he's in a fight. I was expecting more of that. I was expecting him to like every single scene to have a different like there's a balance beam over here.
My question for you guys is, what makes a bad movie enjoyable for you? Because I know it's not for everybody. Like, there's some people that watch Manos, the Hands of Fate, and they're like, this is the greatest thing ever made, and they can watch it over and over again, or like The Room or something like that. But I know it's not for everybody. What works for you guys for a bad movie?
I think any bad movie that I loved as like a teenager was something that I watched with other people, and we would make, you know, crack-wise about what was going on screen and have inside jokes and all that kind of stuff. So I think had I discovered Gymkhana as a teenager, that would have been like the perfect place for that. It would have been the perfect kind of movie to sit around and like razz it. So that to me is what makes it like if it's fun to watch in that regard, then it's so bad it's good.
I like when it's when there's like delusions of grandeur. When like with The Room, you're like, oh, this guy thinks he's making a masterpiece.
Yeah.
And that has a bit of this here. And it's, of course, being razzed. This, of course, was featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000. And they took the word Gymkhana as, like, anytime they were watching something with an action sequence, they would yell, Gymkhana, as, like, someone hits somebody else. So it has that same sort of reputation. It's not good. But there's also this weird out-of-time quality. Like, this is 1985. This is the same year as, like, slick productions like Back to the Future. This feels like a movie made in, like 1978.
Yes.
Yeah, I would have guessed this was a 1980 movie. There is, it does look like apparently they shot this in Yugoslavia, and it looks like they just like used old cameras that were lying around.
Yeah.
That we just found in Yugoslavia.
And they also made like just ethnicity. It was just kind of like vague, maybe Eastern European somewhere.
The emperor is just like clearly an American guy who just like he sounds like Mel Brooks when he talks. He's got a big bushy mustache.
You are all men of courage and skill. You've already shown that by surviving the difficult journey into this country. Yakmala!
They just spent all of the time and specificity on how the game works and the different levels of the game. And you don't have to worry about anything else. Just focus on the game, Graham.
And I like the other thing that was notable is they had hired some extras that were like missing teeth or had a weird eye. And they kept showing them in the crowd sequences, I guess, to make it seem more authentic.
So speaking of authenticity, in the Village of the Crazies, those actually were people from a local mental health institution.
No.
100%. And Kurt Thomas was just like, they just came to work for a bunch of booze in a buffet and they had a great time. We didn't actually punch and kick them. Those were stunt people. But like all those people you're seeing are actually
people show up and they're getting kicked in the face.
Have a buffet.
In terms of exploitation movies, this could have gone way, way worse. Yeah.
It also has not one, but two instances of a dummy falling a great distance. And then just landing with like a boneless thud.
Oh, man. Okay, this is also the same year as Rambo 2, Rocky 4, and as I mentioned, there's probably like 14 other American Ninja, whatever, but this is specifically American Ninja, which is about like more communist dictatorship-y sort of stuff trying to come in. So it is interesting that this really does grab on to that that same feeling of, yay, America, we're going to save the world through various martial arts.
Yeah. And really, that was the same year Rocky IV came out. Holy cow! What a rich communist era.
It really is.
I mean, it was it sort of felt tacked on, the like, oh, this is also to defeat Russia. It was like, it felt like it had to be, like, legally.
But when you get into it, gymnastics actually, and the reason why, one of the reasons why gymnastics became such a big thing is that up until Kurt Thomas and Mary Lou Retton and those people, those were categories specifically that were won all the time by the Japanese and by Russians, like every single time. So when they started winning, that became one of those symbolic, like, we are the greatest nation. Now we're beating our two biggest competitors, because China wasn't a competitor at the time.
Right. And didn't Russia boycott the 84 Olympics to make it a lot easier?
They did. That's one of the reasons why the Americans did so well, because the Americans boycotted the ones in Moscow in 1980. That's why they thought the Olympics were going to be the last ones in L.A., because leading up to it was the Moscow Olympics, followed by the Montreal Olympics. And the Montreal Olympics were like a famous disaster. Apparently, they lost so much money on that. They spent a ton. They lost a bunch of money. And then the Olympics weren't even going to be in Los Angeles. They were going to be in Iran. And then everything went down in Tehran that went down in Tehran. And then they were like, okay, well, I guess we have to send it to L.A. And then L.A. set up, like, it's actually really interesting what they did. They had, like, the first emails set up so that the different people could email, like, journalists and stuff internally. This is, like, 1985 email, which is wild. They had all these, like, media connections that, like, they were then promoting these Olympians as stars, which had never happened before. It was always like, oh, yay, we're it's the American, not it's Mary Lou Retton. Right. So this is the first time they create celebrities out of him. Leave it to Los Angeles to do that, of course. So this the Olympics then really changed the game of what that what the Olympics was going to be. It saved the Olympics.
Was this the only gymnastic movie, or was it like, was it such a craze that there was like other ones that they kind of rattled off really quick?
Actually, you'd be surprised. So there was another one in 1986 called American Anthem, which starred the previously mentioned Mitch Gaylord, as well as Mrs. Wayne Gretzky, Janet Jones, and was directed by Albert Magnoli 2 years after he directed Purple Rain. And if I can direct you to an earlier episode of the podcast where we talked about Teenage Dream / Fly-In, which is all about gymnastics, as well as featuring a very, very young Keanu Reeves in one of his first roles, as well as a dancing Dennis Simpson from Polka Dot Door. That was a really good episode. I totally recommend it.
I like measuring things with James Bond. Like, you know, something's popular if James Bond starts doing it. Like, he'll start doing karate in one movie or parkour in another movie. I do think it would be great if there was, if this movie was so popular that like Timothy Dalton was doing on a pommel horse
to tumble.
Yeah.
All right. I'm leaving us on that note, just with the image of Timothy Dalton just doing gentle somersaults over and over again with his long, bandy legs. All right. When we come back, we're headed back to Motown. It's The Last Dragon, and that's coming up after the break. Although Motown didn't produce or co-produce a lot of movies, we sure find a way to talk about a lot of them on the podcast and on the TV show. From The Wiz to Mahogany to Thank God It's Friday, the Motown production stamp is a guarantee of high drama, high quotability, and of course, an amazing soundtrack. But if you were to say Kung Fu by way of Motown, I still don't think you can imagine the glorious spectacle that is The Last Dragon. It's a pity this movie would be the last of the Motown production features, because to me, it feels like they were just getting started defining a lot of the imagery of the decade. If you haven't seen The Last Dragon, it's kind of hard to explain exactly what happens, but we are going to try anyway. And by we, I mean Graham. Graham, do you want to give this one a go?
Sure, but at any point, if I'm forgetting anything, feel free to jump in, because there's a lot goes on in this film.
I'm just going to jump in and say, and then Vanity shows up.
Yes, yes, Vanity shows up. That was a big moment in the film. It starts with a young man who's completed his training. His mentor has taken him as far as he can go. And so he says, you got to go and meet the master or whatever. You have to go meet him. And I'm going to give you this medallion and give it to the master, and he'll be able to, I don't know what it was, but he'd be able to finish
it. He was owned by Bruce Lee. It was a piece of Bruce Lee memorabilia. And he will recognize your achievement as a martial artist through this memorabilia.
So then this guy hits the streets of New York, and he dresses the whole time in like traditional Chinese outfits. And there's a lot of people playing against stereotype in the film. And so he's very trying his best to not be offensive, I think. But he goes into this city. Meanwhile, we have a bad guy who is trying to make his wife or girlfriend into a pop star. And so has decided that Vanity, who's got her own kind of countdown show, he's going to get her to put the music video on her show to make her, his girlfriend, a star. All the while, there's a piranha tank in the apartment, and you're like, that's going to come up later for
very
sure.
Very important plot point, the piranha tank.
And so during the show of Vanity, she actually plays like a real, what is it, Rhythm of the Night or something? Was like the song?
DeBarge, yeah. It's DeBarge's Rhythm of the Night. And you see the whole music video.
It was awesome. I was like, oh, this has got great music in it. And then out of nowhere, William H. Macy shows up and does like a quick two-sentence cameo.
In a windbreaker. In a glorious windbreaker.
Saying that some bad guys are going to be coming looking for her.
Yeah.
And then we never see him again.
That's right. We see him in that one warning. And the set that Vanity's on is amazing. It's all neon and giant screens. And she does a number. She sings. Anyway, so she's fantastic. She's heading home from after the show, and she's about to get abducted. And our friend, the hero, he goes into full karate mode and kicks all the bad guys' butts. And then she takes off with the medallion. He loses the medallion, and he ends up having to go meet her to get the medallion. And then stuff starts happening romance-wise. And then so all these plots, all these various plots converge, you see, and the love story and the action story and the kidnapping story and all this. And meanwhile, there's a whole other plot going on with a guy who says he's the master, and he has like a bunch of henchmen, and he's kind of, there's some break dancing in the movie, and he's got an awesome costume and an awesome hairdo.
And a great name, Shownuff.
Shownuff. And he keeps asking his troops, who's the best, Shownuff. So you kind of forget about that plot line for a while. That goes away
for Well, yeah, it's really unclear what he wants.
He just wants to be the best. That's the thing, right? Like, that's when he first shows up in the movie theater. He's just like, challenge me. Like, he doesn't need anything else than just to be the best.
He wants to be the best. And he clearly is. If you see his costume, it's the best one in the movie. And then meanwhile, there's a plot still with our hero who's trying to find his master, and he ends up going to a fortune cookie place looking for the master. Turns out the master is just a robot that makes the fortunes. So he goes back to his mentor and says, what the hell, man? There's no master. And the mentor kind of lets himself off the hook, like, no, you got to look in your brain. That's what I meant to do.
There's like a real Red Shoes moment of like the magic was inside you all along. Yeah.
And then finally, the showdown between him and the mob boss who's trying to get his girlfriend famous, that happens. And then following that, after he's defeated all, following that, Shownuff shows up, and he has magical powers. And just when you think our hero is doomed, he discovers he has magical powers too. He defeats Shownuff. And then the mob guy gets arrested, and everybody's happy. Vanity gets away, and I believe that's credits. Am I missing anything in that plot?
No, I think that's about right. You missed the ultimate battle brawl with all the kids from his. That's my favorite part of the movie, is all the battling and all the kids, featuring a very, very young Ernie Reyes Jr. Do you know who that is?
No.
Okay, the little kid that kicks ass, right? The little boy. That's Ernie Reyes Jr., who would go on to be Kino in the Ninja Turtles Secrets from the Ooze, as well as a bunch of other stuff. He was a fight choreographer. So was his dad. His dad actually choreographed a bunch of the scenes here, which is why he's in it. And his dad owned like a string of karate dojos across Southern California.
That's amazing.
So that's little Kino. he's so cute.
Yeah, I forgot. There's also a plot line of him teaching a teaching a karate class, and then there's also a plot line of him and his little brother, and his little brother has a crush on Vanity. There's so much going on in this film. I feel like Gymkhana was really a lot more linear than this film, but it was man, what a rush watching this. It was great.
Had either of you seen this movie before?
Mm-mm. I had not seen it, not heard of it.
No.
Really? Not even heard of it?
Like within 15 seconds, I was like, this movie's going to rock because it's just it's got this great music and it's this guy's showing off his moves. And,
well, and like, it's produced by Marion Barry of Motown.
Yeah, I was like, this is going to be great. And it was.
Yeah. Berry Gordy.
Sorry. Marion Barry was the mayor of Washington, D.C. I get my berries mixed up.
That's all right. There's very few, there's many a berry, so yeah. It's easy to get them kind of squashed together, I understand.
Oh, boy, that's how you make a jam.
Well done. Way to run with that one. So we've talked about Motown Productions previously on the show, specifically talking about The Wiz and Mahogany. Now, Berry Gordy's only movie that he directed was Mahogany. And if you've seen Mahogany, that's another big old mess of a bunch of stuff going on. But like Motown had some genuine hits. Lady Sings the Blues was one of their first feature films that they actually produced. And that movie is amazing if you haven't had a chance to see it. It's Diana Ross and Billy Dee Williams as her husband, and she was nominated for an Oscar for her like debut film, and it's really, really something special. And then they figure out that like what people really want is like they want the music, they want like bright lights and like MTV stuff, and that's kind of what they do from there on in.
Right.
And this is like the perfect encapsulation of all of that. Is this is very much like MTV in movie form.
Yeah, and it's it works. Like it's, you're right, it's like a precursor to music video. I mean, there was a music video in the movie. A couple, actually, it seemed like. A couple big, you know, dance and singing numbers. But yeah, I think they were right. If they were like, this is where movies should be, I think they were correct. More movies should be as fun as this one.
What were your guys' favorite moments here?
I mean, I love when Shownuff shows off that he's got magical powers. As soon as that happens. Because they do that 80s thing where, like, red kind of surrounds, like, kind of Ghostbusters.
Or like Tron. Like I kept thinking about like Tron laser stuff.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. Shownuff is great. The performances are so great. Like the kids are all good. The kids have so much dialogue and they do it. Vanity's great. And the three guys at the Fortune Cookie Factory are all great.
It's, yeah.
It does like. What Jim Cotta lacked, this movie had.
Yeah. This has just so much joy in it. Like, there's this, like, celebration of martial arts, but also of, like, the music and, like, I mean, the love story makes no sense whatsoever about why, like, Vanity would be into this total weirdo. But it's just such an alive, bright, fun movie that just doesn't stop. And part of that is because, are you guys familiar with any of the works of Mike Schultz?
What did he make?
Oh, a lot. Okay, so his calling card really is Cooley High, which we talked about on the show, which if you haven't seen, cannot recommend that one enough. Car Wash, of course, which is an iconic film, released the same year as Last Dragon was Kush Groove, which stars people like Sheila E. and Run DMC and the Fat Boys and New Edition. So obviously he, you know, knew his music stuff and really know how to play it. Speaking of music stuff, he also directed the absolutely bonkers Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, which is very good because of him. Despite some other people, I cannot recommend going back and listening to that episode enough because that story is bonkers.
Nice.
But he's still working. He works a ton in television right now. And at one point in the 70s, there were really only two major African-American directors working, and it was Mike Schultz and Sidney Poitier.
Oh, shit.
So this guy, as you would put it, Graham, has an incredible resume. But he's so good at working with kids, and he's so good at the, like these big, bright musical numbers that are sort of over the top, but still kind of grounded, so you're like, so it doesn't feel like Jim Cotta. We're like, oh, we're doing this now we're doing this, like everything here still has a flow and never really falls off the rails.
And it's also like very clever thing that they've done where they show so many clips from Bruce Lee movies that it feels like Bruce Lee is one of the characters in the
film.
Yeah,
they do kind of pad out the time with this. Like the montage went on a long time.
This also falls squarely into the Bruceploitation category of films. Are you guys familiar with this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Graham, what about Bruceploitation?
It was all, every movie had some kind of spin on one of his movies. It would have Dragon in the title or whatever. And there was a list of them, like guys who were either had the last name Lee or the first name Bruce, or kind of like cover band versions of Bruce Lee. And they made these movies that were like basically carbon copies of Bruce Lee's work, but cheaper, I guess.
Totally. And some of them were like Shaw Brothers movies, right? So they didn't have like super low production budgets. But what was so wild about them is that they would use actual footage from Bruce Lee movies or from like Bruce Lee's actual life, including his funeral. And then they would like piece them together into things. My personal favorite of the impersonators was Bronson Lee, which was half Charles Bronson, half Bruce
Hell
Lee.
Yeah.
So who obviously did revenge movies. But there's like hundreds of these. And this falls directly into that, which tells you just how big Bruce Lee was, especially in terms of like the mystery of his death, right? Like half those movies are about the true story of Bruce Lee.
How do they get the footage, though?
It was a big enough event that there would have been like news footage of it, stuff like that.
Oh, really? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because there wasn't there a big like Hollywood movie that was also about his death?
There was. And actually, the book by Robert Klaus, who directed our last movie, is what that movie is based on.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. Holy shit. It all comes together.
It sure does. We don't just arbitrarily pick these two movies, Graham. Everything has a tie. We do our research here. We're very professional.
You can't just take a bunch of, like, I can't make a movie now and just like, I'm putting the Avengers in it.
Yeah, no. That's just what I'm doing. No, it goes beyond that. Then they had a TV series because they had a bunch of the off cuttings of like the Green Hornet where he played Kato. And they had all of that. And they just recut all of these old scenes of Bruce Lee into a television series. Way posthumously.
Oh wow. I also heard like during Green Hornet was popular in China, it was recut to make Kato the hero. Like it was called Kato over there, and the Green Hornet was just like his secretary, basically. His driver, his secretary.
If you want to go back and listen to our episode on Kung Fu from 1978, first season, there's a lot about the African American connection to Kung Fu. And that's starting like from the very beginning of when these films would be playing, because they would often be inexpensive films. They'd be playing in a lot of neighborhoods that would be very urban. So there'd be a large African American population who saw this. And then they would get really attached to the idea of the self-defense and the discipline and the making something of yourself and the personal growth aspect of it. And it just became really big in that part of the community. And then they started combining it with blaxploitation films.
Right.
Like Jim Kelly obviously was like huge.
Black Belt Jones.
That's right. And Cleopatra Jones incorporates all that as well. So you have this kind of melding of these genres naturally, which then all comes to fruition in The Last Dragon.
Yeah. It's and also there's like any movie of that kind of like a break-in or whatever, that kind of ilk. You can watch people breakdance forever. It's the most fun thing to see, like a bunch of kids breakdancing. Everybody stops and lets the one guy in the middle do something. It's an easy way to make your movie like 25% better. Just have a scene of breakdancing. They don't do it enough anymore, if you ask me.
But then you also have this fascinating thing that they're doing that I'm not sure if it's okay or not, but it is happening, where they are incorporating Asian Americans speaking in jive talk.
Please, I must see the master. It is very important to me.
Look here, chump. The master don't see nobody, especially no jive coolies.
Yeah, he don't see no one who don't know how to get down, baby.
It's very complicated, and I'm sure there could be a lot of unpacking of it, but it's just a really interesting aspect of this film.
I also, that was probably my favorite gag in the movie, where they were playing dice in the factory before he shows up, and then he says he has his own version of craps. And it's, what do you call that? Hopscotch?
Yes, it's hopscotch.
I thought that was like a good, like, Naked Gun level kind of joke. I thought that was a pretty funny, right in the middle kind of movie. It was funny, too. That's the thing, is it also was very, very funny.
Yeah, it had, like, it Gymkhana took itself very seriously, even though it was quite ridiculous. This had, like, it was light, and it had a good tone. People making the movie got it. They understood what, you know.
Yeah.
We know this guy's not really. He doesn't really have magic hands.
Well, what did you guys think of the lead, Timac?
Oh, I thought he was great. Yeah, he was great. And he played this because he's very soft-spoken in the movie. And he really let his muscles do the talking. Like, they didn't. I felt like every scene they had people who were quite good actors surrounding him. So kind of. Because obviously he was very good at the martial arts part of it, but he was just this kind of soft-spoken man. I don't think he had a ton of dialogue in the film, really. Like I say, everybody was kind of acting around him, which is a great, that's a great technique.
He kind of had, like, yeah, he could fall back on the fact that he was kind of like confused by their ways.
Yeah, just put the blank look on. So he's interesting because he is a martial artist professionally. That's what he's always done. And Ron Van Cleef, who was one of the choreographers of the thing, he choreographed the opening battle scene in the movie theater. That's Ron Van Cleef. Fascinating guy. Also came up with Bruce Lee. He was known as the Black Dragon, did a bunch of exploitation films. Fascinating human being. If you have time to look him up, please do. But he was part, Timac was part of his class, and he's the one who kind of recommended, hey, I think you should have a look at this guy. Apparently this role was so coveted, like people like Lawrence Fishburne, Wesley Snipes, like all these young African-American actors who were like all coming up, were all auditioning for this role, but they wanted someone who could actually do it. So Timac showed up to audition on the very first day, and he thought it was like a presentation of his skills. He didn't realize it was an audition. So he showed up and like took his shirt off and was ready to do his kata. And they were like, here's your lines, if you wouldn't mind reading these.
Kid, you've got the part.
Yes, I don't know. Well, no, he didn't get the part, but he was really upset about that. So then he went on a road trip with his dad, and he was just fuming about it because he's like, I messed it up, and I really wanted this, and I feel bad about it. So his dad was like, well, let's run lines right now, and when we get back, you can call that casting agent and demand he give you another chance. So that's what he did. He practiced the lines. He figured out what it was. He went back to the casting director, and the casting director was like, good enough, and you can do the martial arts, you're hired.
Wow. That's a real, you know, a story of stick-to-itiveness that, because it's very rare that people who are casting will be like, yeah, come back in. We hated you before, but come on.
Our mistake.
I feel like because he had like Ron Van Cleef's initial seal of approval of like, this guy can do the stunts that you need him to do.
Right.
That probably helped, right? Like, I mean, we now know Wesley Snipes and Lawrence Fishburne to be action stars. Like, they're both amazing at that. But like, who knows what they were capable of in 1985?
Yeah. No, it was good to have a guy that knew what he was doing. And the fight scenes were great.
But so did, like, and Jim Cotta had a guy who knew what he was doing. That didn't seem to help.
Which, those are some of the best scenes where you're watching him actually do his thing, right? It's like, it's neat to watch people actually do the thing that they do. It's one of the things I don't like about a lot of modern movies, and we've talked about this on the show before, is they don't take the time to teach people how to actually do the thing. Like, they don't do the 4 weeks of cheerleading boot camp when they're doing a cheerleading movie anymore.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, like Scott Pilgrim, they were teaching them all how to fight before they did it. They don't do that anymore. Now they just cut away from everything, and it looks like they're hitting and it looks like they're kicking, but they're not.
Right.
It's just so fast, you don't actually see them do the thing. And I always love watching them do the thing. That's why I'm there to watch an action movie. Act.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like Keanu Reeves in John Wick. He's actually doing all his own, you know, fighting and being choreographed. And
it looks great. It's when you go back and watch The Matrix, they're all doing the same thing, right? And you forget that that's what action should look like. You should be watching them do the thing, and it's cool.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You never see the Hulk do his own kicks.
Yeah.
That's all CG.
You want that Dave jump kick moment in your movie.
Exactly, right. And in The Matrix, that was when Lawrence Fishburne finally beat out Timac for the role.
That is true. Well, Timac, the story is actually a little bit sad. So he was offered two more movies based on this. There were supposed to be two more Last Dragon movies, but he was advised by his lawyer not to sign them. The first movie, he only made $60,000. The second movie was for $100,000, and then the second one would be the one after that would be $150,000. No options, no points on the back end, nothing. That would just be what he was paid. And the lawyer was like, yeah, do not sign this. This is a really, really bad contract for a franchise. And Berry Gordy, who up until that point had like really taken him under his wing and was like taking him to all these meetings and introducing him to people, taking him out for dinner, having him live in his home for a few weeks while he was like looking for a place to live in LA, just cut all contact and ties with him and said, we're done. If you're not going to sign this contract, we're done. So it's just like, and it seems like he didn't want to talk about this movie for a long time. He's now come back around to kind of dealing with it because I think he realizes what this movie means to a lot of people. Like, he gets approached in the street all the time with people who grew up with this. They love it. And through that, like, he seems like a pretty centered, been to a lot of therapy guy. Like, he talks the talk of therapy, where he's now come back around to, he gets people love this movie, and so he can love it through that.
Right. That's too bad, because like $100,000 in 1985, like, you could buy a house and two cars for $100,000. I don't understand what he was so mad about.
Yeah, but if you're starring in a mega franchise, like, you think if they offered that to Bill Murray for Ghostbusters 2, he would have taken that?
I don't know. He's an unusual character. Who knows what he
Harold Ramis. Let's say Harold Ramis. Let's go with someone who's slightly just as crotchety, not as wacky.
I mean, I could easily see Harold Ramis being paid the least for Ghostbusters.
I can see that. Well, he worked out fine. Like, I'm not worried about him because he became a really sought after choreographer for dance. Like, he worked with Madonna on her Drowned World tour. He choreographed Janet Jackson's Let's Wait a While. Like, he found his place in the world. Don't worry about Ty Mac. He's fine.
I couldn't sleep last night.
You're genuinely concerned. What were your guys' thoughts on Vanity? Now, I do have to say, we will be calling her Vanity for the sake of clarity, but in her later years, she did renounce that name and did not want to be called by it. Her name was Denise Matthews. But for the sake of clarity, we'll say Vanity.
Oh, Vanity.
I do like that when the movie starts and it's got two lead actors who only have one name. that's great. She was really good. Mm-hmm. Like, all the acting is better than it needed to be through the whole movie.
Yeah, and she's she's got, like, charisma for days, and when you see her hosting this thing, you're like, yeah, that's something that she could easily be doing. And yeah, and like Dave said, like, her acting was great. She was kind of funny.
So I thought that maybe it would be a great idea if I got myself a bodyguard, you know, like someone to guard my body.
In the scenes where she was like cracking jokes and. Was that actually her singing and dancing in the scene? Yeah. So that was like, great.
Are you familiar with the Vanity story?
No. I knew that later she didn't want to be Vanity. Like, she became a Christian or something like that.
I knew that Vanity Six are like in the Prince world, along with a few, you know, whatever are the other bands that are in Purple Rain.
More Stay in the Time of all of that circle. Yes. So she's actually from Niagara Falls in Canada, interestingly enough. And she was Miss Toronto, and she competed for Miss Canada. Like, she was on the beauty pageant circuit. And then she moved to New York to become a model. But she was too short to do any of the runways. But
so
she was killing
it. Went to gymnastics.
She could have. She missed her calling, Dave. She missed her calling. But she was doing a ton of print and that kind of thing, which is how she kind of ended up in the rock and roll world. And she was Rick James's girlfriend and went with him to an award show, which is then where she met Prince and hooked up with Prince. And Prince wanted to recruit her for a band he was calling the Hookers. And he actually wanted to call her Vagina. And she said, that's not happening. And so he said, well, how about Vanity? And she says, I can deal with Vanity. And then that's when.
that's his compromise.
First of all, imagine, like, good for her.
Yeah.
Like, this guy's so famous. He wants to make you a star. Here's the hitch.
You're going to meet a band called the Hookers, and your name's going to be Vagina. Here you go.
So good for her for, like, saying, hey, that's a bad idea. And, like, how famous was Prince that he was like, yeah, whatever. All of my ideas are good.
Have you ever seen, like, footage of him when he was 19 years old on the, like, when he first burst out doing the interview circuit? And, like, he's got this, like, little, the head cock thing he would do, kind of looking up, talking to, like, I think he's talking to Dick Clark in this thing. And he's like, well, how long ago did you start working? And he just holds up four fingers of, like, four. Working for 4 years. Like, he doesn't even answer his questions. He just does, like, this little side look. And Dick Clark is, like, doing his best to be like, and so you weren't comfortable with other people producing your music? No. It's just like, at 19, he was Prince. Like, it's just some people are just like that, right? Being a genius does not make you a good person. I'm just saying.
Well, that's not been my experience.
Being a genius, like, but also being a genius doesn't mean all your ideas are genius.
That is very true. Well, so the two of them were together because I'm sure both of you know the song Nasty Girl, right? I've had that song stuck in my hair for like 3 weeks now, thanks to this movie. So she was actually on Team Prince, as you mentioned. And then right before Purple Rain came out, that's when she and Prince had the fallout. She was supposed to be in Purple Rain. And that's when they replaced her very quickly with a very similar looking Apollonia.
Yeah.
And so she then went over to Motown, because Motown was like, we're going to give you a 4-picture deal. We're going to give you three albums. You can do what you want to do. So
we're going to give you $10,000
for four movies. More than likely, actually. So, and she wanted to get out of, like, she never really wanted the sexy image. That was all Prince, all the lingerie, all of that. She's like, I wanted to style myself after classic Diana Ross. And that was not happening on the Prince camp. And because that was already what was associated with her, she kind of had to keep going with that. One of the things I do appreciate is that she got engaged to Nikki Sixx at one point.
Holy
so she
shit.
Was about to become Vanity Sixx again.
Oh, man. What a dance card.
Well, there's an entire section just on her relationships on Wikipedia.
Wow.
Like, it gets pretty intense. Adam Ant wrote the song Vanity about her. She was together with Billy Idol. Like, if there was a very controversial pop star who was male in the 80s, she was linked to them.
Why isn't there a movie about her? That sounds like a fantastic, I would love to see a biopic about.
There should be. She wrote before she passed. She passed in 2015, unfortunately, very young at 57 from kidney failure. After she was addicted to crack cocaine, unfortunately, and after an overdose, her it affected her kidneys, and she ended up on dialysis for the rest of her life. Yeah. But while she was having her overdose, that's when she saw visions of Jesus telling her to come back to him and come back to the fold, and so she became a born again Christian for the rest of her life. But in 2010, she wrote an autobiography called "Blame It on Vanity," being like, it's not Prince's fault. Nothing is anybody's fault. I made my own choices. Anything I did is all on me.
Oh, wow. That's a kind of a tragic story, and
yeah, totally. But yikes. But for me, I'm like, what a fascinating woman who took time to like reflect on her life and what. Yeah, because she had an incredible life. Like, everything that she did is like, you were a megastar. Like, you were one of the biggest mononymous. What is it when there's one name? One name
mononymous,
is mononymous?
Yeah.
That would be it. Okay, that's it. People out there, like, she achieved shit that people dream about, right? Even though it ends sadly, she came back to the point where she needed to come back to.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never blame it on myself. It's all Prince's fault for me. It's also everyone else's fault.
That's fair.
But she also she's very convincing as like a showstopper. She's very like convincing as this kind of like would be famous even if this movie wasn't making her famous. She just looks like somebody who would be famous, you know?
She's gorgeous. I mean, she was doing album covers. She's on the cover of one of Chromeo's albums when she was still a model, right? Like, there's just something very rock and roll captivating about her.
Yeah. Wow. Holy cow. I'm gonna hit that Wikipedia page, I tell you.
Please do.
The plot being that the bad guy, Eddie Arcadian, wants to have his girlfriend's video on the show, and that throws him into this violent rage.
Man wants what he wants.
It's a little thin, but he is so good, and the girlfriend is so good.
Well, she's a multi-Tony Award winner. Like, she's a Broadway star. So that's why.
That was the
I think if you make a movie in New York instead of LA, you can get these Broadway people. You can get William H. Macy.
Yeah, yeah.
This lady who was I forget what the song was, but it was
Dirty Books. The Dirty Books is.
Yeah.
I love it. I actually thought that song was a banger too. I'm like, if you put that, I mean, she's meant to be styled after a Cyndi Lauper, right? But like, it's a really good Cyndi Lauper ripoff.
I
was doing a Cyndi Lauper parody, that's it.
Well, to tell you the truth, Eddie, it couldn't be any more boring than hanging around here with all this cook in my hair while you guys go play cops and robbers.
It was the only thing that didn't hold up logic-wise because her videos were awesome. They were awesome and her songs were good. So I don't understand why they would be like so resistant to putting it on the show.
Because if you can't put – would you put that on next to DeBarge?
Yes, I would. And that's why I'm not in that job. I would screw it up so fast.
Speaking of the music, what was kind of your guys' favorite musical number out of this? It, of course, being a Motown movie.
I just like where there was the big breakdance montage. That was great with all – where it was like everybody was wearing white. And there was a lot of the dancers. And I think that's when all the breakdancing broke out. But also the movie theater – where everybody was going bananas was a lot of fun.
Vanity sings this song. I'm assuming it's called Seventh Heaven, which I believe was kind of hard to put things together. But was that the like theme song for her show?
Yeah, that's the name of the club is Seventh Heaven.
Oh, okay.
Right.
I couldn't tell when we were in the club or the TV show, but it that was great.
Yeah.
But, you know, that 4 minutes of DeBarge. 4 minutes of DeBarge, 6 minutes of Bruce Lee, and then you got yourself a movie.
It's interesting to me what movie or what songs took off. Like, obviously, DeBarge became a massive hit. Charlene has Fire in this, which is like the romance theme. And that bombed so hard, she didn't record again for 13 years. So Whoa. It's one of those things where it's like, it's weird what takes off and what doesn't. And maybe just where they positioned it. Like, the DeBarge, you have the whole music video, whereas the Charlene one is just in like the intimate moments. And it's no Take My Breath Away.
Was this movie successful? Like, did enough people see this movie to know that Charlene song?
Oh, yeah, 100%. This movie made, I mean, it wasn't in like the top 10 of the box office, but like it made enough money in the groups that it needed to make that they wanted to do sequels, right? Like, they were going to make a franchise out of this.
Oh, well.
They had a system.
But that DeBarge song wasn't famous before that movie?
Nope, that's where it comes from.
Holy shit.
Wow.
No, that's... Yeah. Yeah, the music in it was really, really good across the board. And... Yeah, it was good across the board. There was no scene where I was like, oh, this is going on too long. Like, it clipped along really quick. But that movie theater scene, man, oh, man. Like, everybody's rooting the movie for everybody else. And then Show Enough shows up and they're like, that's beyond the pale. This guy's ruining the movie for everybody. Yeah.
I like it. I really like is that is a very diverse movie theater. There's people from all walks of life in that movie theater.
Yeah, yeah.
It's New York, baby.
And on that note, I think we're going to end this episode because how can we go any further than that? So, Graham, thank you once again for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
It was such a pleasure. Dave, thank you for joining us for the first time, hopefully not the last.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This was fun. Now, do you guys want to tell people how they can listen to you make funnies?
Yeah, we're both on a show called Stop Podcasting Yourself, and that's produced by Barry Gordy. And yeah.
You're on $10 an episode contract.
Yeah. But, you know, once we make, you know, a few more years of it,
yeah,
he's going to bump us
up.
Exactly. We're living with Barry Gordy now, too, which is good.
All right. And listeners, if you want to learn more about Bruceploitation, I am going to send you over to the Important Cinema Club podcast with our friends Justin DeClue and Will Sloan, because they are extremely knowledgeable about that genre. But you can join us in 2 weeks, where we're going to be looking at Canadian weirdness, joined by the champion of the Canadian film industry himself, Jay Baruchel. It's The Peanut Butter Solution and Crime Wave. That's coming up in 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. And today featured Graham Clark and Dave Shumka as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.